Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast, the MERS political newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, and Samantha Schreiber and John Rurink are going to be joining me in a little bit. But right now here in MERS World Headquarters, I've got John Selleck from Hardware Strategic coming over across the hall. Thanks for coming over. And we're joined by an old friend, Bill Nolling. He is a longtime public relations professional, worked for governors, majority leaders, House speakers, and all the rest. Bill, it's good to see your face again. I don't remember that beard though when you worked down here.
No, this is the post Lansing beard here.
Yeah, yeah. Is that the Orthodox Church beard?
Yes, yes. This is actually short by those standards. So
you're involved in the Greek Orthodox Church or something, aren't you?
I was. Yeah. We're members. So.
Yeah,
I used to direct the choir, but I don't direct the choir anymore. So
see, Bill's moved to stage two. I can't go there. Shave our head, yes. I can't grow a mustache, let alone one as pretty as that. So I'm stuck here.
I have to have something to break up all this head. So
well, Bill, I wanted to have you on because you have a connection to the Ukraine, and I thought you could kind of share with our listeners a little bit about that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. My wife is a first-generation American, but her parents were born in Ukraine and emigrated over towards the end of World War II. And we live in a community in Brighton that is, it used to be predominantly Ukrainian, but it is less so now. But there are still quite a few of the folks from the Ukrainian community that that live out there. And most of these people have family in the western part of Ukraine, which would be anywhere from Kyiv to Lvov and east or west from there, and not so much the eastern side. And there's a real kind of cultural split in Ukraine between those from the western side of the country and those from the eastern side. The eastern side have traditionally always been more Russian in their view, and the Ukrainians from the western part of the country have always been more European, more westward looking in their outlook. Mm-hmm. So we have, and my wife has relatives, distant relatives, cousins that are in Kyiv and Lviv, which is western Ukraine, and Chernobyl, which is in western Ukraine as well. So we hope they're well. We haven't heard from them, but we hope they're well.
Well, what's been her view of what's been happening?
You know, it's a... not surprising. I mean, you know, to look at this issue, you know, in the West, we tend to look at this as a NATO issue, but from a Russian standpoint, or an Eastern European standpoint, or even a Slavic standpoint, this is really a cultural war that Russia is waging here. This is about kind of the eternal Russia in terms of how Putin, but also a lot of Russians see themselves as, you know, the central part of the Slavic people. And so they're trying to extend their sphere of influence to recapture that. And there's a lot of sense. And if you go back and you read kind of Putin's long missive about how they're, that he posted last year, how Ukrainians are Russians and Russians are Ukrainians, and it's all this one kind of Rus or Slavic people. I mean, you can really start to see that this is like getting the band back together. This is eternal Russia. They see this as, and Putin sees this as, a fight for kind of the cultural soul of the Slavic people, with Moscow and those in power in Moscow as the center of that. So that has a lot to do with this, more so than NATO, because Russia has NATO troops against its border and has for years. So that's not as much of an issue. It's about, you know, what happens internally when a group of people who have expressed their desire to move away from Moscow, which the Ukrainian people have done, what that pretends for other republics within the empire of Russia, you know, Kazakhstan and places like that, where there are people who have a different cultural viewpoint than necessarily what is in central and Moscow and St. Petersburg. So, I mean, it's a complicated issue, and it goes back centuries. The western part of Ukraine was never really part of the Russian Empire. It was always part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the Polish Empire, or even the Lithuanian Empire. So there's a real disconnect culturally between people in the West and people in the East. And you're starting to see, you know, you see that play out. I do think Putin has probably bitten off more than he can chew on this. But in the end, he's got more bombs, he's got more tanks, and he's got more people. I mean, it's pretty simple how, without any Western intervention, how this, you know, how this war will end. And it's not going to end well for the Ukrainian people.
Well, it's interesting because probably all three of us grew up with the Soviet Union being the boogeyman, the bad guy for us. That was a central organizing figure, not only for international relations for us, but politics even, and the Republican Party, right? Mm-hmm. Free trade, strong military, Ronald Reagan stopped the evil Russian Empire. Yep. And I saw an analyst the other day that said America's been lucky, basically been on a 30-year vacation from fears of world war, and boom, we're back. Really
yeah,
fast.
I mean, and we're not only are we back, yeah, not only are we're back even, we've like doubled down on that. I mean, the Cold War was never this bad and never this overt. And so, I mean, you know, we're in a completely different era right now. And I do think that some of the critiques from the foreign policy, people that follow, you know, this kind of East-West foreign policy is pretty on the mark. You know, we've had our head in the sand, so to speak, about what was going on in Russia and what Russia was really about. And like I said, a lot of us here think it's about NATO. I think it's actually more about reconstituting this kind of cultural Russian identity that they're trying to maintain and establish, especially in the peripheral republics of, you know, on the western part of their frontier.
So where do you think it ends then, Bill? I mean, if it's getting the band back together, then does that mean trying to reestablish the Eastern Bloc, Romania, Poland, you know, keep them as more like Soviet, I guess, friends or allies as opposed to, you know, conquering them outright?
You know, I don't think, you know, I mean, some people will say that, you know, you got to check Putin because, you know, if you don't check him, he's just going to keep rolling west. And I don't see that. Right now, he's making an argument. It's a historical argument, and it's a tenuous argument. But for the people in Russia, it's an argument that has some credence to them. And this argument goes like this. These people have always been part of one Slavic people. We are the continuing empire of that Slavic people. They need to be part of us. That's the simplified version of that argument. People in Russia can see that and say, yeah, you know, they are just like us. They, you know, they have been part of us. So I think what this ends up with is that you're going to have, you know, the aggression is not going to stop until they take Kiev. And that's going to be a brutal fight. But once they take Kiev, I would not be surprised if you see Russia divide Ukraine.
Oh, really?
right down the middle. There's a, you know, there's the Dnipro River, which pretty much divides the country between east and west. And that has always been kind of the Russian frontier in their minds. So I would not be surprised if you see something like this. The other thing is that you have to realize, you know, China is sitting off in the shadows on this. But China gets a third of its grain from farmers in Ukraine. So at some point, this becomes, you know, a pain point for the Chinese. And I would not be surprised to see Premier Xi come in and try to broker some type of peace arrangement as kind of the dispassionate third party, so to speak, not West, not Russian, certainly not Ukraine, and to be able to do that. So I think that has yet to materialize, but that's not going to happen until after Kiev falls. Russia's not going away. No one's kicking Russia out.
I agree with Bill in the sense I think that Putin and a lot of others in Russia, having done a lot of late night doom scrolling, that makes me a YouTube expert, looking on the history, going back to Kievan Rus and all this other stuff I didn't even know existed in the Empire of Lithuania. I'm sure he does think that all those Russians should be brought back in, Russian-speaking people should be brought back in, but that's not a 2020 way to handle things. This guy is a killer. He's ruthless. People, families are dying left and right. And that's because he wants power and he wants control to protect himself at home because he's weakening. And he wants a legacy that he made a bigger Russian empire so that he seems more famous. He wants the statues of him to be up, and he's willing to kill a whole lot of people to do it. And it's pretty darn disgusting. I've got a lot of family, half the family basically from Poland. My grandma, my great grandma came from Prague to escape all that kind of stuff, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. All those people don't really buy the argument that he only wants to go as far as Kiev. Or Kiev, he's gonna keep on rolling whether he can. He'll either do it in big chunks, or he'll do it in the little baby chunks, like he did on the eastern side of Ukraine over the last 7, 8, 10 years. We already know if you look immediately one country west of Ukraine to Moldova, the little skinny area that's been trying to claim its independence. I can't pronounce it, Transnistria, I think, or something like that. They're claiming they're Russian, so you know he'll probably pop in there next, and they'll just keep like slowly eating his way west until he stopped.
Bill, I wanted to ask you a question on those political candidates who are trying to make the argument that, well, you know what, Ukraine isn't exactly like the saints of the world. I mean, now they're getting taken over by Russians, so everyone's basically coming to their aid. But it's not like they were a great, you know, good actor to begin with. There was a lot of organized crime there. There was a little bit of corruption going on there. It's not like they were great to begin with. Talk about that as a selling point for a political candidate. Does that work at all?
No.
And I'm speaking of Robert Regan, the new candidate in Kent County in particular. He's been talking this way.
Yeah, I think that's a rather naive approach, you know. So the flip side of that is that we should let a more powerful nation just massacre a weaker nation because they're somehow corrupt and not worthy of defense. I don't buy that, and I don't think Americans buy this, you know. If Putin's sole aim was to disrupt NATO, he's had the opposite effect. That's why I think there's actually a bigger aim culturally, internally for him here than there is before that. You know, I think, you know, my advice to candidates is knock on doors and raise money and try not to be foreign policy experts, especially in a campaign year, because they're not particularly good at it. And it's just fraught with
landmines.
Yeah, so to speak, or bombs, you know, projectiles and bombs, you know, it's not, you know, it doesn't end well for them. And, you know, last time I looked, there isn't a huge Ukrainian or Russian population on the west side of the state. So
do you agree with them, John?
Yeah, for sure. But what we know, overall, because the basic layer of, direction that Donald Trump puts out is you're either weak or you're strong.
Yeah.
And he admires what he thinks is strength, which are the bullies of what's going on over there. He's just talking about North Korea and their leader again over the weekend at the RNC meeting down in Louisiana for whatever reason. And so that goes down to the rest of the party. But the other bad part for Ukraine, as far as that part of the party goes, is that it's been labeled as part of the Biden corruption, the Biden son getting, you know, payoffs or contracts or whatever. And so you can just say, oh, it's all a Biden problem. It's Biden corruption. It's Biden being weak. And that just becomes fodder in whatever today's campaign issue is going to be. And who knows what it is tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, John, I think you're 100% correct. You know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when I first started getting involved in politics, you know, if Ivan poked his head up out of a foxhole, Republicans would have went ballistic about it in lockstep. And now they're not in lockstep about that. And I think we can thank Trump partially for that. But I also think that there's just been a shift in kind of America's gaze towards its neighbors and its sense of place in the world amongst the conservative side of the ledger here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've not seen that.
All right, so Bill, we're going to shift gears here now. Let's focus a little closer to home in Michigan. I want to get your thoughts on what you think will be the big issue in this gubernatorial campaign in 2022. And if you don't think that this will be the big issue, what you think should be the big issue going into 2022?
You know, I think that it comes down to bread and butter issues every time we get into a campaign. So I think we're going to look at, you know, first of all, are the damn roads fixed? I mean, that's such low-hanging fruit. I mean, it was from the last campaign. And having driven through, I don't know, seven states in the last 2 days, I can tell you that the worst, absolute worst by a factor of X is Michigan, without a doubt. And those roads aren't getting fixed anytime soon. I didn't see a lot of construction going on, maybe on 275, but that's about it. So I do think that there's, If Republicans can, you know, give up what I call the conservative Tourette syndrome that they have around the election and focus in on the governor's performance, they might be able to make some traction on how, you know, how the nursing home during COVID, how those deaths were managed or not managed. I think that they've really blown an opportunity there to define the governor in a way that makes it hard for her to step aside from it. And I do think that there's going to be, you know, some focus on the reach or overreach of government from the COVID pandemic that's going to play. I think it's going to play more regionally than not, because it just, I think it's going to break that way, but who knows? But I think the big issue is going to be, you know, are the roads fixed? Did the government, you know, there's going to be, you know, some type of scrutiny and prosecution of how the governor managed COVID compared with other states. And you're going to see the whole troop of GOP contenders and wannabes from the South, you know, filtering through Michigan during the campaign, talking about how they did just fine with no mandates, no masks and no vaccines. And, you know, their economies are doing just fine. So I think that in my mind, that's what shapes up on that.
Do you agree with that, John?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, first, as campaign operatives or planners, you love the issues where the wind is already at your back and you just get to jump on the train and ride and you don't have to spend money to create it. And that's the economy and that's inflation. And this is absolutely insane right now what's happening with inflation. And even if no one is going to be able to say that Governor Whitmer caused higher inflation XYZ or believe it, they got to hit somebody for it. They're going to be mad at somebody for it. And she's the one that's on the ballot right now. And then the other issue, basically, like Bill is talking about, if you wrap it all up into a bundle, is competence. Joe Biden won the presidency because he gave the impression that he could meet a basic level of competence going forward on COVID and some other things, turn the temperature down. Instead, the world is still spinning out of control. And you look at the polling numbers prior to the State of the Union, where even independent-leaning or Democrat-leaning independents are like, this guy is not up to speed right now. He's 78, you know, God love him, but doesn't have the mental ability to stick with this job. It's a tough job. So he's really struggling on that front. You start adding up all the things that Bill just talked about on the competency front for the governor, nursing homes, roads, keep ticking down UIA and the billions lost there. It's going to be like probably a death of 1,000 cuts on that front. At least that's what the attempt's going to be. And I find interesting the roads issue because, yeah, it was a huge deal for us in 2018 when we were running in the governor's race. The governor's team came up with that slogan. It was pretty good. It worked for her, but it cuts both ways. You know, the sword that you live by is the sword that you die by. And for the last 2 years, because of the epidemic, the polling numbers did not show that roads were really high in people's priority list. They were trying to survive the pandemic. But all of a sudden, the world seems to be kicking back into gear. And lo and behold, the typical Michigan spring comes along and the roads are literally peeling apart before our eyes. I just took a flight to Texas where the roads are much better, but much better weather. I'll give them that. On my way down I-94 to the airport, I saw four cars on the side of the road, literally bumper to bumper to bumper. They were all hitting the same pothole. They all had flat tires.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Like it shocked me. And I basically saw something similar on the way back, more flat tires, because the top layer of asphalt that in Michigan, you know, we traditionally lay on top of the broken roads beneath it is peeling away like it always does. Except now everybody is not as worried about the COVID pandemic. They're back on the roads. They're back doing things. And now the roads are going to shoot back to the top.
All right. Well, thank you for your time, John and Bill. It's good to see you again. Appreciate you joining us for this segment of the MERS Monday podcast.
Great to be here. Great to see you guys again.
And just so you know, there is a new opening here in state government for a Republican spokesperson. If you're interested, we'd love to see you back up here again.
You know, at some time you got to put your spikes down and you got to start coaching. So,
all right. Well, I just thought I'd make just a reminder. We're missing you up here.
Good to see you,
Billy. Hey, if you need a quote of the day, you can call me anytime.
Sounds good. Sounds good, Bill. All right, take care.
See you. Bye.
Joining us now for the podcast is Mike Harris. He is a Republican candidate in the 43rd House District and now the nominee after last Tuesday's victory at the polls. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Mike Harris? Who are you and how did you get to this point of being the Republican nominee in the 43rd State House District?
Sure. So first and foremost, I'm a family guy. I'm married. I have 6 kids. That usually gets me a couple wows. I have 3 still in high school and I have 3 out of high school. Okay. My oldest actually just recently returned from serving in the U.S. Air Force. So she's back home in Michigan now, which is awesome. And, my kids have really inspired me to do a lot with my life. So my professional background comes from law enforcement. I'm a 26-year law enforcement veteran, and I just retired this last March from the Waterford Township Police Department. I had a great career there, working in a great community. It's one thing I've really appreciated about this district is its outreach to its first responders. They've been very supportive, which is why my family and I decided to put our roots here. And we have kids in the Clarkson School District. And matter of fact, my son placed in the Clarkson varsity team for wrestling in the state finals last year, right before he graduated his senior year.
Wow. What weight class?
He was 153 or 152. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Did he have to run around with a plastic bag over himself to get down to 152 or?
That poor kid did everything. It was crazy watching him go through his weight loss program. But yeah, he normally walked around at about 165.
Yeah. Holy cow. That's amazing what the wrestlers go through to drop weight. It's never ceased to amaze me. And you were at a wrestling tournament this past weekend too, right?
I was. So there were 5 kids. We still stay pretty tight to the wrestling community, even though we had our sons graduated. So we were down at Ford Field this past weekend. And we had 5 wrestlers that made it to states and they did a phenomenal job. It was really exciting to watch.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's great. What are your other kids involved in?
So I'll kind of go in order. So I told you my oldest was a Air Force veteran. She actually just finished her bachelor's degree in business and she's enrolled in her master's program now. So she's working on that. My son that was the wrestler is going into pipe fitting. So he's a skilled trades guy and he's working his rear off right now down in Detroit. And then my other son took a little break from school, but he's planning on enrolling, in a mortuary science program. Hmm. And then I have twin girls that are seniors this year. And then our youngest daughter is, a junior. So they're both just getting through high school. They're kind of exploring their options on what their goals are in life. So,
wow. So how did you find time to decide to run for state office? That seems like that takes a bit of work here.
It does. Well, I figured, you know what? Law enforcement prepares you for a lot of things. And I can't think of anything better to prepare you for politics than dealing in law enforcement. So you develop thick skin, you develop great mediation skills, you learn how to work with a variety of people. You're already ingrained into the public in which you worked, which I this community for 25 years. And I've always kind of been a people person. So, you know, I couldn't think of a whole lot better place to go than to Lansing. And, you know, public service really is at the core of my being. And I've been a public servant for a long time. And I'm full of energy still. I'm not ready to give that up.
So were you in Waterford the entire time for your law enforcement career?
So I started off right before the academy. I worked for Iosco County Sheriff's Department. in the jail. They have a seasonal program. And so I did that right before I went to the police academy, get my feet wet. And then out of the academy, I was hired by the Durand Police Department, which is out in Shiawassee County. And then I was only there for a few months, and Waterford called and hired me. So I probably have about 26 years total.
Mm-hmm. Now, folks think of Waterford and they think, geez, well, that can't be a high crime area. Tell our listeners a little bit about some of the more interesting cases that maybe you were involved in during your time there.
Sure. Well, you know, early on in my career, one of our famous cases was Jack Kevorkian. So Jack Kevorkian kind of put us on the map with a few things, and he had a couple of assisted suicides in Waterford. And so we worked with Oakland County, because there were some that they were in charge of the investigation. And, you know, jointly, we prosecuted Mr. Kevorkian and put him in jail. So, again, early in my career, that's kind of one of the national headline things that we were known for.
Did you get to personally pull over the van?
I did not. Oh, I did not.
That would have been a great story.
Yeah, right. You know, Waterford has its own airport. So it's the Oakland International Airport. And so for years, we dealt with the Red Wings and the Pistons and mm-hmm. all of those flying in and out to go to the Palace or to go to the Silver Dome. And so, you know, we met a lot of very interesting people, and mm-hmm. it was a great time. And it was kind of the who's who of celebrities around the area. You know, like I've pulled over Eminem and you know, Sergei Fedorov and some other people. And it always makes for interesting conversation.
Did you give them each a ticket or not?
Some yes, some no.
Okay. Some got a stern warning, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, Waterford as a whole is a phenomenal community. It's actually routinely been in the top 25 of Michigan safe cities. And, you know, our police department and firemen and EMS, they really work hard to make that happen. And, you know, they work well with their local government. And it's just, you know, we have a little bit of everything. You know, we do get some homicides every year. I was in charge of our fatal accident division. So we handled, you know, the fatal car crashes. And so there's a little bit of everything, but not a lot of everything, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Joining us here in the studio as well as our publisher, John Rink. And John, if you got a question here for Mike Harris, jump in, go ahead.
Well, hopefully you didn't ask this guy. I came in like two or three minutes late. I'm curious about your consulting firm, Paladin. Tell us a little bit about that and what kind of work you do with that.
Sure. So I guess let me go back in time just a little bit. So I've been a small business owner in the district since 1997. We started off as a martial arts school, ran martial arts for quite a number of years. And, you know, as all businesses do to survive, we evolved. And we really took a hit back in the 2008 recession. And we kind of, in 2001, there was a major law change for concealed pistol license training. Well, I'd been a firearms instructor at the police department since 1997. And so my partner and I actually got together and we developed a concealed pistol license training program and really started evolving my business into the firearms training. And that lasted for quite a few years. And again, we evolved based upon the needs of our clients. And we split and no ill will, but you know, we just had different focuses on what we wanted to do. And so we started a new company called Paladin Training and Consulting. And we focus more now on security consulting and trying to help churches, schools, mainly private schools, businesses prepare for things like active shooter, robbery prevention, safety awareness. We've even taught classes on counterfeit currency and things like that.
And you also do some PI work, right?
I do. That was my segue from law enforcement. You know, I came home for 2 weeks and my wife said, get out, get a job. No, I'm joking.
When you were doing the CCW training, were you moving around the state or did you stay right in Waterford?
We went around the state a little bit. Our focus was in the Waterford-Clarkston area. But we did get contracted with other organizations to travel around the state. So we did that as well. We've probably trained about 2,000 people just for field pistol licenses.
But anyway, so yeah, so tell us about your PI experience.
Yeah, so the PI work, I actually work for a former Oakland County Sheriff's deputy. She's a sergeant. Her name's Jane Boudreau, and she owns Jane Doe Investigations and Commerce. And it's a fairly large PI firm, and I had heard that there was an opening, and so we had a mutual friend that kind of put us together and went in for an interview, and it was, we hit it off right away. And I now help manage their special investigations unit, which handles some of their larger, more complex investigations. So, you know, we have some very large clients. Of course, I can't necessarily tell you who they are based upon our confidentiality rules, but there's some very interesting ones that have hit the news. We've helped local departments in police departments in helping with missing person cases and so on and so forth. Some in Waterford, as a matter of fact. So it's been a great segue from my law enforcement career into handling other investigations.
What does a public investigator, or what does a private investigator do? Because I know we watch the movies, we glamorize it quite a bit, that you're undercover and busting people and doing stakeouts and eating a lot of donuts in your car and a lot of dead time. But what do you really end up doing?
You know, a lot of people, because of television and movies, we always think about, you know, domestic type situations where we're spying on a spouse or a boyfriend or girlfriend. And really that's such a small part of our business. We handle a lot of insurance work, and, you know, we do a lot of workers' comp cases. We do a lot of auto investigations. We also do a lot of civil, and we even do some criminal work. We're part of the Wayne County Indigent Defense Investigators Group. So we do help with defensive cases. We also help with, you know, again, some major civil cases around the area. But probably the largest clients we have are attorneys, and dealing mainly with insurance work.
And sniffing out insurance fraud, basically?
Yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
How much insurance fraud is there out there? I know that we'd just gone through a huge change in our auto insurance law. Was there that much auto insurance fraud to sniff out? And is this new law going to change that?
Well, I guess time will tell on if it's going to change things. But, I can tell you there's routinely been lots and lots of auto insurance fraud, you know, just insurance fraud in general, you know, and it's unfortunate. You know, I think most people are great and they go through the proper channels and do what they're supposed to do. But there's some people that feel they can take advantage of the system. And, you know, the police officer in me, of course, wants to put a stop to that. And, you know, I love that I'm in this type of position where we can help catch people that are frauding the system and making it more expensive for the rest of us.
And then, since you do have a law enforcement background, there's been a lot of conversation in this city, in this town, about the lack of law enforcement officers across the state. Can you kind of put that in numbers a little bit? Is it something that you can quantify and give our listeners a little bit of background on how bad it is?
Sure. Well, I'll give you a more of a personal experience. So when I hired into Waterford in 1996, there were, I believe, 12 open positions, and there were 400 people testing for those positions. Fast forward to this past year, and we had 12 open positions at the Waterford Police Department, and I believe we had 16 applicants.
Oof. Wow.
It is not a popular job anymore. And I think, and I'm not blaming any one person or one entity for the problems with it, but, you know, the national temperature for law enforcement, has not made it a glamorized position like back in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, I think we're paying the price for that. And we've seen, you know, again, some of this had to happen, but we're seeing with the recession and whatnot, we've seen benefits cut, we've seen pay cuts. And again, all the things that used to make the job very attractive have started going away. And I think we need to find a way to really encourage people, because we still need, obviously, very honorable people to take up that position. And, you know, and whatever we can do to help get people interested in the job again, I think needs to happen.
You've talked a lot about issues, Mike. I'm wondering if you've got an idea of what you want your first bill to be about.
Well, obviously, I am not a defund the police guy. You know, I would love to see either something to help support law enforcement or first responders in general, because don't get me wrong, while the police are short-staffed, the fire departments are seeing the exact same issue. You know, it's just all around the first responder thing is not as glamorized anymore. So I'd love to see something to support the hiring and retention of police officers. Also, you know, something near and dear to my heart is the small business community. And, you know, I think our businesses and our local economy have taken a huge hit over the last couple of years. And we need to do everything we can to help bolster that local economy and support these businesses that are just hanging on by a thread.
What do you think of Donald Trump?
Well, I love the guy. I supported him in his campaign, but I always cringed when he got near a microphone, you know, and I think a lot of people share that sentiment. I loved his policies, but, you know, sometimes he was not the guy that you wanted at the forefront, talking off the cuff and not following the teleprompter. You know, he wasn't always a gentleman, but I do believe he always had this country at the forefront of his policies. And I think we're in some of the trouble now that we're in because he's not in office, or another strong patriot is not in office.
Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to just kind of close this out by talking about what it was like to campaign in such a condensed time frame as you just did. You basically campaigned for 2 months in probably the coldest weather of the year. What is that? What is that like? Do you go door to door? How do you connect with people, and how do you end up, you know, crafting a strategy that wins?
Sure. First and foremost, I had lots of help. And, you know, in a condensed race like this, and again, this is my first run at a public office. And, you know, so I had some mentoring from two former state reps in the district, Gail Haynes and Jim Tedder. And, you know, they were very integral when it came to crafting what my strategy would be in the campaign. And I'm sure you already know my campaign consultant was Dave Forsmark. So between the three of them, we really sat down repeatedly and came up with some different strategies. And actually it was just full throttle, and you just can't stop until the end. So, I mean, really, that's what we did. We did a little bit of everything. We condensed a year's worth of campaigning down to about 11 or 12 weeks. And it was everything from, you know, having phone banks set up with volunteers, knocking doors. I had some great support from state reps that were coming out and helped me knock doors, as well as community volunteers. As you know, I got some endorsements, and some of those groups that endorsed me actually sent out volunteers as well. And it was a huge team effort. And really, that's the only way to handle it, I think, in a normal campaign, but even more importantly in the short one. And, you know, I kind of felt like I was back in law enforcement again, because, of course, we work in any kind of weather. The cold did slow it down a little bit, but people were shocked when I hit as many doors as I did. And the number one question I got is, what in the heck are you doing out here? It's only 0 degrees. and so it started, it was a great icebreaker, no pun intended, but, you know, it really led to some meaningful conversations in the community, and you know, I really valued it.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Mike Harris, he is the nominee for the Republicans in the 43rd State House District. Appreciate you being on the podcast.
Anytime. Thanks for having me, guys.
Joining us now for the podcast is the state senator out of Grand Rapids. She is Winnie Brinks. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Happy to join you today.
All right. So the first question I have for you is, have you met Robert Regan before?
I have met him. You know, he came to one of my coffee hours, I think maybe in 2013 or 14. So I did have a brief conversation with him then. And of course, around here, he is a known quantity. He has run for office, I think, for state rep 4 times, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
So I have met him.
All right.
Oh, wow. What was that engagement like?
You know, it was pretty brief, so not a lot to report there. Certainly, his quotes in the news are much more remarkable than that meeting was.
Yeah, so what do you make of that? Being kind of almost an apologetic for Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, you know, this is incredibly disturbing to me, and that's just one of the topics that are disturbing about the things that he said. And I think even further, the idea that the Republican Party here in Michigan is embracing that kind of rhetoric from candidates and even from some sitting legislators is really a huge red flag. And so I'd be interested in hearing what they have to say about some of the things that he said, but it's certainly disturbing.
Isn't it weird that of all the things that you'd think the country would be united about, being united against Russia is maybe not one of them?
Yeah, you would think that's an easy one for us, right? And again, just one of many topics where he is just dangerously conservative, and to see the Republicans just welcome that into their fold is a scary thing for us as a state, I think. So, I think it's interesting to see them head that direction. They really seem to be embracing insurrectionists and this dangerous rhetoric. And it would be important in my mind that they take a step back from that and denounce some of that dangerous behavior and dangerous rhetoric.
Now, actually, last night, Michigan Tea, the social media account, sent me a message. And this is a post that he had made in May 2021, where he describes feminism as a Jewish program to degrade and subjugate white men. And that definitely, I didn't even know how to respond when I got that sent to my inbox. I was like, oh my God, what? It's terrible. But, you know, obviously the West Michigan area is very unique. I mean, in the last 10 years, a lot of people have been moving in. It's definitely evolving. You have areas that are still kind of more conservative, while also these very progressive hubs. What do you think that the people in today's Grand Rapids want out of their elected officials, especially with so many new people coming in?
So, you know, Grand Rapids is unique from the area that he is running in. Grand Rapids is solidly Democratic, and I believe would never, ever vote for a candidate that talks like that. So the city of Grand Rapids itself, he does not represent. That is something I can say unequivocally. Outlying areas in West Michigan, are there pockets of people who might encourage his kind of rhetoric? Probably. But certainly Kent County is not one of those in general. You know, he won by only 81 votes. It was a 3-way primary. And so I think that to say that this is reflective of the voters would be wrong. I do think it is reflective of a certain extreme segment of the Republican Party. And that's what you see in some of these primaries in deeply partisan districts. And that's exactly what that is. The new district, I will add, that he needs to run in if he wants to continue in this job after this term, after the special election for this term, if he wants to come back next year, he certainly has to talk with a different audience, a much different audience. And it's a 50-50 district, not a deeply partisan district. And we happen to have an excellent candidate there who will be a great person as an alternative to some of that extreme rhetoric that he is spouting.
Now, Senate Democrats, there's some really exciting districts for this year with the new districts, the new things that have been created, and there's a chance that Democrats have a real shot at winning the majority after not having one since, I believe, early 1980s for the Senate chamber. How do you feel about that? What's the excitement been like?
Yeah, I just can't tell you how excited I am. You know, for 10 years, we've been marching in this direction toward majority. I've always been in really tough seats, and we've always had to fight for representation here on the west side of the state. We are feeling as a caucus very unified, very together. We are fundraising well. We are Very excited about the high quality candidates we are getting, not just returning, incumbents, but candidates coming from the House who are great for the districts that they're running in. We've got new recruits that are excellent candidates, excuse me, who just have great presence in their community, and we are very optimistic that they'll do really well. So we're very excited about our chances of flipping those districts from red to blue, and then of course flipping the chamber. So we're in the best position that we've been in since I've been around, and probably the best position that we've been in decades. So very excited about our prospects this year.
Now, I know you made a tweet. Someone had tweeted at you about one of the new congressional districts, like, oh, Senator Brinks, we would love for you to run in this seat. And you said, I believe it was along the lines of, like, I feel like I'd be able to do more as the Senate majority leader.
Yes, that's right.
It makes me ask, like, what would a Democratic Senate majority look like? You know, how would you come out swinging if you get your wish at the end of 2022?
Yeah, certainly. I think you'd see us be focused on issues that really matter to the people that we're serving, right? I think we've seen Republican leadership go down these sort of extremist and marginal issues and focus on a lot of things that are really divisive and really just kind of promote hate in our communities. And I think you'd see Democrats focus on things like affordable housing and attainable housing. You'd see us focus on respecting teachers and strengthening schools. You'd see us be focused on reducing the cost of healthcare and prescription drugs. Those are the kinds of things that people are concerned about and want to see us addressing as a legislature. Those real kitchen table issues, making sure kids get the preparation for the jobs that we have here and that they pay enough to support a household or a family. So all of those things are the things that we are really, really eager to get back to focusing on as Democrats. And I think, the Republicans have just been wandering around out at the edges and not really doing the things that the people really would like to see us focus on.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about energy and the fossil fuel debate, because obviously Elon Musk came out this past week about wanting to really unleash the United States oil supplies because of everything going on and how the Russia's invasion of the Ukraine has kind of emphasized just how many countries have become dependent on Russia for oil supplies. Do you think that Democrats need to get a little bit more flexible or kind of surrender to certain realities because of the current global crisis when it comes to oil?
I think Michigan as a state has limited impact on certainly the global environment when it comes to energy. We're all paying a lot of attention to what's happening over in Russia and in the Ukraine, trying to make sure that we are taking lessons from that and learning what that means for us here. I think overall, the goal here is to move in a sustainable direction and to make sure that we have the fuel that we need at an affordable price for the people of Michigan to heat their homes, to drive their cars. But make no mistake, there's a very strong commitment here to moving toward a sustainability and to less dependence on fossil fuels and on foreign sources of energy.
How does that translate to Line 5? Because I know that that's been a big item of contention. But if we're cutting ourselves off from Russian oil, should Line 5 continue?
So, Line 5 is a complex issue. It has there are federal factors that have an impact on it, as well as state issues. You've seen that fight go on in the courts. You've seen us with limited ability as a legislature to really actually make an impact on that. So, the combination of that kind of fuel moving under such a precious and important body of water has always been a concern for me and will continue to be. So as we move toward energy sustainability, I would certainly like to see a productive conversation about that and moving away from the need for it to be there at all.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get back to the recruiting effort for the Senate Democrats as you guys look to take majority in 2022. A big news last week in getting Kristen McDonald Rivett into the race. Would you say that's the best or the biggest name recruit, biggest win on the recruiting stage that you guys have had so far?
oh, I don't know if it's the biggest. It's certainly one we're very excited about. That's a district that's key to majority. And I think having a strong candidate there is incredibly important. But you know, as things shape up throughout the campaign, we'll see various districts be in play. We are very optimistic about the entire group of candidates that we've recruited. So I'm optimistic about her, and I'm really excited about her chances, but I'm also very excited about others.
So we've got in the 12th district, it looks like we're going to have Kevin Hertel over there on the Macomb County, St. Clair Shores, Lake St. Clair district. And then it looks like Padma Kupa in the 9th district. Looks like she's good to go there. The 11th district, though, I haven't heard anything out of that. That's the one that starts in the city of Detroit for just a little bit, then goes northward through Macomb County, through Roseville, Fraser, Clinton Township. That would be Senator Michael McDonald's district, but it's going to be a competitive district. Who do you guys have there?
Yeah, we have a very promising candidate there. I would say stay tuned. In a couple of weeks, you'll see an announcement from her. We're very excited about her. She's got great roots in the community, and we're thinking that she will be a great challenger for him. And it's certainly a district that we will not be ignoring.
Yeah.
And then I kind of want to talk about that Lake Michigan district that is now more Democratic leaning, which is where also Senator VanderWaal is going to be competing in. How are you feeling about that district?
Yeah, we're feeling really good about that district as well. It's certainly a district that leans our way. It's almost 50-50. We've got Terry Sabo over there, and he's been an excellent state rep over in the Muskegon area. This district would carry up to a couple of counties north of that, where we've had a strong presence of folks who have, you know, Democrats who've been present there in northern Michigan along the coastline that have never really had an opportunity to vote for a viable Democrat there. And they are very excited, very fired up to get out and see what can be done over there in that neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm. And is that bittersweet at all? Because obviously, you know, Senator VanderWaal is the chair of the Health Policy Committee, which you also serve as the minority vice chair. It seems that the Health Policy Committee, especially after the pharmacy benefit manager legislation was signed by the governors, it seems that it's been pretty productive and that both you and him have been kind of keeping things on track.
Yeah. So, you know, always happy to work with a Republican who's got who's willing to work with us. Right. But in terms of our priorities, a good Republican is never as good as a good Democrat. Right. So being able to make sure that we are electing somebody that will continue with the priorities of our entire caucus instead of a Republican is always going to be our priority.
Best case scenario, how many seats can the Senate Democrats win?
Oh, man, best case scenario. Shoot. I wouldn't be surprised if we are approaching 23.
Really?
You know, yeah. I mean, that you're asking for best case scenario. 23, mm-hmm. 24 could be in the works, but it's certainly a year where the map has changed considerably. It is much more reflective of the partisan balance in our state. And I think if you look at past voting trends over the years, and hopefully we'll have a positive environment to run in with between having solid candidates, good fundraising, and a positive effort. I think we're in great shape.
How much does the president's approval ratings concern you?
You know, it concerns me a little bit. I think more important is that our governor seems to be doing much better than the president. And I think that's our top of the ticket that will have the most impact. I think we've got a very strong presence from Dana Nessel and Jocelyn Benson. They've been doing great work in their areas. So all of that will be really helpful to us. Over here in West Michigan, I think we'll have a really active congressional race. So when I look at, you know, all the names above mine on the ballot, I'm feeling very good about having a very positive and strong presence. And that will have more of a determining factor than Biden numbers.
Now, so you're a Democrat who also focuses a lot on health policy legislation, and that kind of makes me want to ask about COVID-19. So obviously the CDC has kind of loosened up its guidelines on masks, different buildings, different companies are getting rid of their mask mandates. What should be the everyday COVID-19 protocol, at least for you? What is your personal COVID-19 safeguard practice?
So, you know, I take a look at what's going on in the environment that I'm going to be in when I decide whether or not to wear a mask or whether even to attend a particular event. You know, this job is very social. It's really important that we get out in the world and see people. And sometimes that means gathering with large groups. So I'm trying to be thoughtful about it. I respect the decisions of organizers of various events or even individuals that I'm meeting with. You know, if they have a particularly vulnerable person in their household and they prefer that we all wear masks, I'm happy to respect that. I do, you know, my own opinions about what a mask policy or something like that should be is really kind of irrelevant. It's mostly about following the best medical advice available and really respecting the people around me.
So as of right now, if you have a campaign event, like a fundraiser, a very big social event, is there going to be a mask mandate to get in or not as of right now?
So as of right now, I would not have a mandate. I would have masks available, and anyone who would prefer that can use a mask. I also, as weather warms, have a preference for outdoor venues, if that's possible, or ones where there's a lot of good ventilation. I just think that's prudent. So always concerned and always watching the numbers. So if the situation gets worse again, or we see another spike or a new variant, we'll constantly reevaluate that. But it's an interesting time. We're kind of in that area where it's a little bit gray. There's no one clear answer. It's really great to get out and see people again. But we do have to always keep in the back of our minds what else can be done to make sure that we're not putting anybody in any unnecessary danger.
Do you see COVID as being still an issue in the 2022 campaign? And to what extent will it be? Will it be relitigating what happened in 2021 and 2020? Or is there another focus you see it taking?
I certainly would like to see us focus on the future rather than the past. I think you see Republicans trying to drag us back into the past, whether it's, you know, the 2020 election itself or, you know, what's happened as we've gone through this difficult period with the pandemic. So I think that there's a real hunger among the people that I've been talking to about looking forward. Where do we go from here? How can we find the positives going forward? How can we be better equipped for what's to come in terms of, you know, education, healthcare, housing? All of those challenges are still here. Some were exacerbated. People are ready to move on and start to recover, to live their lives again. And so that's what I think we're going to see the most traction on.
All right. Well, thank you for taking time with us here today, Senator Winnie Brinks out of Grand Rapids. Appreciate you being on the MERS Monday podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yes. Oh, thank you. I'm a bit disappointed I wasn't able to get to nerd out with you on PBM and pharmaceutical legislation. That's my favorite.
Well, some other time.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Senator Winnie Brinks there for taking time talking with us. Also, Bill Nowling earlier in the podcast, and Mike Harris, state representative nominee in the 43rd District. And Sam, you noticed here on the Zoom call with Senator Brinks, she had some plants in the background. You kind of got nerded out there with your coffee mug here, too. It's a coincidence.
So I would definitely say that I am the houseplant enthusiast of the MERS office. I have a few plants around here that I kind of sneak into the building when no one's around.
And we appreciate it, too. It makes things look a lot nicer, and it always makes the air a little fresher when you can get some oxygen in the air.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But honestly, it was a really exciting day. Senator Brinks also likes to add some serenity to her space with some plants. So
very exciting. Yeah. Very, very exciting. I'd like to thank, for the first time, Mark Bayshore is doing the producing of the podcast. Really appreciate him extending his expertise, trying to make this sound as good as humanly possible. Always thanks to AT&T for sponsoring our podcast. John Rurink for coming in a little earlier, helping out with that interview with Mike Harris. And until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.